This is Classic Rain Hamcast number 23, posted July 11th, 2020. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Last time we brought you the first of two excerpts from an interview with amateur radio pioneer Leo Meyerson, W0GFQ, conducted in 1988 by Glenn Baxter, K1MAN. Here's the conclusion of that conversation.
In my early days, I played around with crystals back in 29 and 30 when they first came out. I had heard through the grapevine that quartz crystals were badly needed. One of the local manufacturers called Howard Manufacturing Company had told me about that. He was making the holders for the FT-243 crystals. I got in touch with a friend of mine who used to cut quartz in his basement. I said, why don't you come in the crystal business with me? I understand they need them badly. And at that time, he was working for the gas company in Fort Dodge, Iowa, making $200 a month. Al says, you know, I'd love to do that with you, Leo. But he says, you know, I'm captain in the reserves, and I'm liable to be called at any time. I said, well, let's find out about it. And then we called this chief officer of the Signal Corps in Washington, D.C., and told him that we could make quartz crystals. And he says, are you sure? I said, sure. And he said, if you can make quartz crystals, we'll see that you two fellows are deferred. And he told us who to get in touch with, which was Motorola. At that time, they were called Galvan Manufacturing Company. We got in touch with Motorola, and they asked us the same question. Can you make crystals? We said, well, we think we can. They said, here are the frequencies we want. They gave us five frequencies, and you get them to us as quickly as you can, six of each. Well, we worked for 3 days and three nights getting those 30 crystals ready, and we took a overnight train, Burlington, into Chicago, took a bus over to their plant. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we were told that the crystals passed, and we walked out of there with an order for 80,000 crystals. We went back home, and we went to the bank, of course, and we were able to get the money that we needed to get the drill presses, which were converted into lapping machines, and all the other electronic equipment that we had to build up, check the crystals and all that. That took us some time, but I guess you might call us successful because we trained 13 other companies. There were no secrets in those days. But I can tell you one of the reasons that they gave us the Army Navy E, one of the few crystal companies that received that. I don't think any other crystal company did. One of the main things that we did was to be able to pick up the crystals as they were being lapped on a receiver. I remember we were using some Hallicrafter receivers. The idea came to us as we thought, why not make use of the piezo electric qualities of crystal? You know, you can make a crystal oscillate by electrically doing it, or you can squeeze the crystal, so to speak, and it'll emit a voltage. And that's exactly what happened. As the lapping crystal was between the two plates with a carborundum in a lapping machine, we could hear the swish on a receiver. We got pretty good at it, and the girls got good at it. They knew when to stop the machine, and then we finally would bring it in the last few hundred kilocycles. But before that, we had to stop the machine various times, take a micrometer for the thickness, because the relation of the frequency is dependent on what the thickness of the crystal is. It's not very accurate either. It comes within maybe a kilocycle or two of the desired frequency. But we saved all that time, wiping off all the grit and the smudge, and we saved all that time. We only had to take the crystals out once. All the other companies were given the benefit of our discovery. I don't know whether we had any right at the time to try to patent that, but I guess we didn't pursue it, to be frank with you. We were too busy making quartz crystals.
So basically, your idea of using a receiver to listen to the crystal as it was being manufactured spread throughout the entire United States and was responsible for all the crystals that were made.
What happened, if we had a certain frequency, we would tune, but we got so we'd know where to, the girls knew just where to set it, or the manager of the department. They would set it to where they wanted the crystal to come to, and when they start hearing the swish of those crystals, it would get louder and louder and louder until they knew the peak. Then they'd shut it off, and they used to be within a kilocycle or two of the frequency we needed. which saved many, many hours of time.
Well, most of our communications in World War II was crystal controlled. Is that not true?
Absolutely. As I recall, a tank needed 80 crystals. And, of course, they have different frequencies depending on the time of day. The morning frequencies would be different. The afternoon would be different than the evening frequencies, just like in ham radio.
What about your very early days in amateur radio as a kid? How did you get started?
I was a young 9-year-old kid when I was fooling around with crystal sets. And there was an older boy next door to me that was a big influence on me, because when you're 9 years old, you don't quite understand everything as clearly as you might when you're a few years older. But at any rate, I did wind some wire around an oatmeal box. He would help me put up an antenna. In those days, we'd put up maybe 60, 70 feet in the air. I had one of the first commercial receivers called a Crosley Pup, a one-tube receiver. I think it used a 200A tube. And all you needed was an A battery, a B battery, a C battery, and a pair of headphones and about a 60-foot antenna, and you were in business. The first receiver we had was a little homemade one-tube set that worked fairly well. And I can remember picking up KDKA when it first came on the air in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I started logging all the new stations, because you can imagine very few stations were on the air in the early 20s. And every day there'd be a new one. It was through those early years that really got me started listening, until I heard this one amateur in 1927. But we did build a little transmitter in 1924, not realizing that there was a law against getting on the air with it. But in those early days, you know, they'd show transmitters on 800 kilocycles, 1200, so forth. And we also was very few broadcast stations. And we did get on the air for about 2 or 3 weeks. I played the piano, and we gave weather reports and little news, and we had quite a listening audience. I think the furthest we ever heard from was 15 miles away.
You're listening to our second excerpt from an interview with Leo Meyerson, W0GFQ. We'll conclude this 1988 interview in a moment. This is Classic Rain, Hamcast number 23. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Classic Rain from www.therainreport.com.
Tell me about your saga with General LeMay and Arthur Collins of the Collins Radio Company.
That was quite a saga. That was in 1956. Butch Griswold, K0DWC, was very friendly with me, and so was Kurt LeMay. He was vice commander of the SAC Air Force Base when Kurt LeMay was the commander. They both were using Globe Kings over there. I couldn't give it to them. I had to lend it to them. And then when they moved out, they sent them back. But I was invited by Butch to visit all the air bases in that boxcar plane of his. He had Art Collins on board also. This was 1956. They were checking out single sideband. And I can remember when Butch said, "Leo, where's your single sideband?" That's a story in itself, because I started single sideband transmitter way back in 1923. I had a fellow that I had a lot of respect for. His name was Fred Berry, out of Kansas City. At that time, I had heard about single sideband, had read about it, and I kind of figured with the little space that it takes in the ham bands that it might take over someday. So I had him build me a 50-watt single sideband transmitter. I spent several $1,000s in getting him to engineer it for me. But one of the problems I had was that my chief engineer, Sam Fedoni, was not in favor of single sideband whatsoever. He called it duck talk, and he said it's no good and it'll never take over. And I said, "Sam, let me be the judge of that. I think the mistake I made is after I got the transmitter, I said, 'Sam, you check this out.'" Now, this was back in 1953. A transmitter came in about the middle of December. I told him to take it home, just about that time, you know, Christmas and the inventories and all that stuff. To make a long story short, we were building our new building, had it built, and we're going to move in 1954, January the 3rd. The old building burnt down, and that had all the equipment, everything in it. It was all packaged, ready to go. We had all my people getting everything organized and cataloged and where it was going to sit on the shelves in the new plant. I remember when somebody called me, he says, World Radio's on fire. And I said, my God, which one? And they said, the old one. If it was the new one, it would have been all right because we still had all of our equipment. I was out of business for a couple of weeks, and I suppose such a good reputation with my suppliers that within 2 weeks I was back in business. And I had sent cards out to all the people that had sent me orders telling them what happened, and if they would wait, I'd appreciate it. And only one person said they couldn't wait, and it was a broadcast station. They needed some tubes. I could understand that. When the smoke cleared, I talked to Sam. I said, where's my radio? He said, I never took it home. I said, you mean to tell me you didn't take that home? You had plenty of time. He said, no, we could never find it. When we looked at that pile of rubbish, we didn't think there would be anything there, but fortunately, the bricks and everything fell in on top of it, and our manufacturing used to be in the basement of that old building. And we found everything there. We found a lot of it got water-soaked, but we found all of the receivers that transmitters that we used to refurbish for our customers. We found many of the transmitters we were building, but we could not find that piece of equipment. And you can make up your own mind what happened.
And that concludes a rare audio interview by Glenn Baxter, K1MAN, with amateur radio pioneer Leo Meyerson, W0GFQ, in 1988. Quoting from an obituary about this ham radio legend published by the National Organization of Amateur Radio, the ARRL, in 2011, for his contributions to amateur radio, Meyerson was named the 1997 Ham of the Year at the Dayton Hamvention. Meyerson collaborated with Jim Musgrove, K5BZH, on his autobiography called In Tune with Leo. Leo Meyerson is someone who really impressed me, Musgrove told the ARRL. He may not have been tall, but he was certainly a giant of a man. In 1927, he heard W9CHT, his first encounter with a ham. That experience really captured his attention. In 1928, Leo got his ham license, W9GFQ. In those days, there was no zero call district. Continuing to read from the ARRL obituary, in 1953, the company name WRL was changed to WRL Electronics and then to Globe Electronics in 1956. In 1959, the company was sold to Textron. Meyerson continued in the retail radio business with World Radio, getting back into manufacturing with Galaxy Electronics in 1962. This company was sold to Hygain in 1970. Meyerson retired in 1977, dividing his time between Omaha and the California desert, and continuing as an active radio amateur until his death in 2011. The Classic Rain Hamcast is copyright 1988-2020, all rights reserved. Congrats to Rain founder and producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, who retired from the workaday world July 3rd. July 4th was truly his independent day. Classic Rain Hamcast number 24 will post July 25th. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from everyone connected with the Radio Amateur Information Network. Keep on hamming!